You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to?
You know, I know Woody's kind of a headbanger, hard rock guy, so I want to apologize for playing the Goo Goo Dolls in front of you, Woody. So, good morning on a Tuesday.
Good morning, Mac. It's the 90s neurons managed to fire when I heard that song.
All right, well, I didn't mean to make you fall out of your chair this morning, but welcome to All Marine Radio.
Thanks for having me once again.
I know you're a busy guy, so I appreciate you doing this. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on. At the top of the list is the Marine Corps of the future and General Berger. Give me your thoughts on that. Pretty interesting. How much will Congress allow the Marine Corps to change? It's plugged into an awful lot of war plans. So if the Marine Corps changes fundamentally, does that mean that there's going to be costs associated with standing up other units, modifying the Army to do other things? It's a pretty interesting discussion that's going on in the Marine Corps about force design in the future.
Now you're spot on, and I think that's going to be as you look here, you know, leaving 2019 and staring 2020 in the face, I think that's going to be the subject of discussion, or the broad discussion area, certainly for the next year. And you're right on. I mean, we have developed as a nation a joint force that has evolved, since the time you and I were captains, into a very interdependent, interoperable joint force. And so the question is, with a force like that, can you change one service, one element, without affecting the others? And I'd say the answer is no. And to one degree or another, particularly the Navy and the Marine Corps are having to really do that hard look and look at their future capabilities against a pacing threat, a peer pacing threat, and certainly in a different environment than we've been fighting in for the last 19 years, basically. So I don't think any of the services are going to be able to sustain sort of a old think model, but probably us, because of our size and because of the unique nature of the MAGTAF, we need to take a harder look than others in order to ensure that we are able to be that force in readiness that we're required to be.
So it'll be interesting. And then somebody sent me an email, and they said, Mac, it's interesting because the Marine Corps doesn't belong to General Berger. It belongs to the nation. What Congress will have a say in this in the course of its normal appropriations. And the email, if I can recall, said, I think that those hearings are going to be very, very, very interesting, because we've heard things like tanks go away, tubed artillery goes away. And then in parentheses he wrote, good luck to the St. Barbara's event of the future when there's only four people there. You hear stuff like that, and obviously that's part of the buzz surrounding all of this. But that, in my opinion, that is interesting. And how different can the Marine Corps become? And then Jeff Kane made a comment the other day fate has a way of playing a trick on you. That which you prepare for is that what you don't do.
Right.
And so how specific can you be, or is it appropriate that the 3rd Marine Division gets tweaked in that direction? But
you're right on, and there's an awful lot of brain power, an awful lot of time and effort going on, across the Marine Corps, but
right.
It's really most prominent here in, you know, Quantico and the greater National Capital Region. I mean, there are a number of planning efforts, planning teams of various types doing their business right now in concert with the force design effort, planning effort that's going on. Because, you know, designing a force is one thing, but how you actually create that force for the future is an equipping, a training and education, a manpower management piece that touches every other aspect of what I'll call the institutional Marine Corps, the headquarters supporting establishment side of the Marine Corps, not the pointy end
right.
as much, but what goes on to, you know, create and sharpen that pointy end. And you're right, and my brother in arms Jeff is absolutely right, because you know you can't afford to be precisely wrong when predicting future conflict, looking at potential threats, and establishing or identifying the required capabilities. There's a huge risk to being precisely wrong, and making yourself designing a force that's so narrow in purpose that if anything else goes on that's outside that mission parameter, you know you're too brittle to adjust. And I think that's one of our greatest strengths historically, is we've been able to adjust and we've been able to do windows. And I really don't think that anything I've seen to date is contrary to that. I don't see this. I don't see this becoming a completely new entire Marine Corps. I think parts of the Marine Corps are going to change significantly, and I think our method of employment, our operational construct, specifically with regards to how we integrate and support fleet operations, is going to change drastically. But does that mean, quote, every Marine a insert your adjective here or your noun here have to change? I don't think so. So, oh, by the way, that's what we, you're spot on, that's what we owe to the American people. And I think Congress just came out with the details of their $773 billion defense bill, which is now going to continue to get played with and tweaked and chopped on. And it will absorb a certain amount of risk in terms of a redesign for the Marine Corps, but it's not going to be wholesale, I would say.
No, and General Berger said that. He said, don't expect to see great changes in the short term, although you will see some. I think you were probably at the dinner, the ground dinner that he
yes.
made those remarks at. That, and I just want to thank you for putting the entire video up on, I don't know if you had a hand in that. But
Yep, absolutely.
No, but it's great for us. And again, I'm a huge fan. Long format, hear it straight from the horse's mouth, as opposed to Mike McNamara or Chris Woodbridge relaying their interpretation of what somebody said. And
that's right.
No matter how high of intellects that Woody and I have, there's always some interpretation in there. So I just want to thank whoever was responsible for doing that. That was awesome. And so again, I think it's very interesting. So have you heard, I mean, is any of this part been briefed? Have any of this been briefed? How do you know about it? Just from conversations?
Essentially, in my
capacity,
catbird seat here as the editor of the professional journal. The good news is I don't have to be responsible for any of this anymore. but I'm in a position where I get to stay close to the issues, have the conversations, periodically folks write on it, and I'll, obviously read and edit their work. That can sometimes lead to broader discussions in some narrow areas. I was fortunate in my time in uniform that, from training and education to, some limited experience with requirements and capability development, I was able to touch a lot of these things. And so you maintain that network right now. Primarily, my purposes in that are to ensure that we're publishing the right things, and we're broadening that discussion in the professional journal, which is what it was originally intended for.
Well, I mean, it sounds like it will be a great boon for you guys, yes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And thanks for the kudos on our website. I mean, we podcast or record and publish speaker comments from all of our professional events. Those are all available on our website for anybody to at least listen to whenever we can. We'll also put a script or a transcript up with it as well. And we were lucky enough to get General Berger's script for that those remarks, which is also available out there if you want to read along and follow along with the Commandant while he's speaking.
Well, and hold him to it in the future. So,
well,
there's nothing that goes down harder than your own words. Not that will ever happen to you. But if you're in that business, you could find that stuff at the Marine Corps Gazette. Would you give them the actual web address of the website?
It's www.mca. That's Mike Charlie Alpha -Marines.org. That gets you to our homepage, and then you can navigate over, scroll all the way down on that homepage to get to the podcasts of those speakers and other podcasts, and then you can use the menus to get to Gazette, Leatherneck, and our other features as well.
I want to ask for your assistance. First of all, I think the last time we fought a peer was in Leatherneck Square in the late 60s in Vietnam. Somebody that would close with us to put our heads on a stick, somebody that would shoot artillery and mortars and rockets at us.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the fighting that went on in the vicinity of Kantian that got to Khe Sanh, Dong Ha, and all, mm-hmm. and Jiaolin and that area, I mean, it was on between the North Vietnamese Army and the Marine Corps, and the 3rd Marine Division, to be specific. I need you to put your smart guy hat and give me a few names of people that are around that would be great interviews to do to expand the battlefield studies. Because to me, when you talk about peer warfare, we haven't done it in a while. I had General Furness on last week and did talking about the large scale exercise that the 2nd Division just completed, and saying, imagine this. Imagine where you can't light off, right, your radars. Imagine that you can't, shoot those microwave shots constantly, that they have to be done intermittently, and then they got to move. So in order for you to have continuous communications while cells are moving, you have to have multiple cells to include your combat operation centers. There's not a big screen TV in any of mine anymore. They're small, they have less people, and we've got to have maybe 3, not 2.
Right.
Now, I mean, that's a world that we have never, we didn't exist in that in Vietnam.
That's exactly right.
And so anyway, I'm interested in that. So if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, yeah, that's, I can certainly help you out with that. Some of these folks, particularly if they were in, command roles.
Right.
At that time are getting a little mature.
Right.
Shall we say, but I think it's important to have that discussion with them now while we still can.
Oh, my God. No, and I'll tell you what, if you talk about a little bit of heaven on earth, my interviews about discipline with General Mattis, General Zinni, General Van Riper, and General Halick, and there'll be more to follow. But, I mean, it's like an hour and a half of professional heaven. General Van Riper talking about 74 Marines in his command were killed in action in Vietnam, I want to say 1966, 67, or 67, 68, when he was the company commander for Mike Company, 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines. And he said, if you throw in the wounded, we had well over 100% casualties. And he said, so all my thoughts on discipline were keeled in my experience in Vietnam, when we couldn't find shackle sheets when there was helicopters inbound, when we didn't know where the smoke was and who had different colors. And
right.
So you hear that, and then I felt almost embarrassed about the discussion that went on about General Van Riper in the second division and the chicken shit discipline that was going on down there, right? And then you hear him articulate it and you're like, I didn't even understand the discussion. And so to have those, especially in long format, with guys who were there and can really talk about, you know, I mean, Delta Company, I think it was Delta Company 1-4 gets overrun in the vicinity of Con Tien when the NVA think that it's a South Vietnamese position and they try to overrun it. The Marines fight all night, right? All night, and they get overrun and then they counterattack in the morning. And I believe it's Delta 1-4. And the stories that come out of that are like, yeah, if you're gonna talk about peer fighting, you know, you really ought to read the articles in the Gazette's digital archives about Leatherneck Square, the northern part of I Corps in 1967, 68, 69, and 70, and see what units did up there, because that's where I would start. That's Marineland. So anyway.
Absolutely, and it's important to recognize that really is sort of the last data point that we had historically for that sort of a peer-on-peer fight. You know, the fight in Vietnam had changed by that point to the final stage of insurgent warfare under Mao's doctrine, where it is conventional warfare.
Right.
And so you were fighting main force North Vietnamese army formations with armor, with artillery, with mortars, essentially everything short of of air superiority. And that's really the last time that we've engaged in that sort of a fight. The difference, as General Furness points out now, is that now we are contested in and will be contested in all domains, which is frankly something that I don't think anyone has ever really experienced. Certainly not because the technology has changed to the point where we've essentially opened up other domains.
When was the last time? The last time would have been World War II, right? Specifically after Pearl Harbor, when we were contested in every domain. Would that be the last time that we were contested?
I would include at times Korea in that that discussion, because particularly in late night winter 1950, as early war with the initial drive of the North Koreans, but then certainly after the PLA entered the war, there was a period when we certainly did not have air supremacy, and even into Vietnam, we were never uncontested in the air. It wasn't necessarily air to air, but the ground to air defense apparatus of North Vietnam, made that a contested fight for strike missions and bombing missions flying north of the fence. So it's depending on the domain, there's been a greater contest. But in terms of the electromagnetic spectrum or the cyber domain, there are aspects of that we've never really fought in yet, and so that's very much new ground. And then obviously space as well, often enabled through cyberspace operations, is another area that will be contested, and some would say is being contested right now by those peer adversaries. So. That's new territory, and the concerning part about this is that for decades, again, I talked about the joint force. We have optimized that joint force with things, platforms, and capabilities that preconditionally need air control of those domains. Air superiority, sea control, and unrestricted continuous communications. Those three pillars are what we've built our joint force capabilities around. In other words, assuming that we're going to have all three of those. Well, now we can no longer validly make that assumption. We're going to have to fight for those three things. And that's really what drives developing capabilities now, changing the Marine Corps, changing the Navy, changing the other services to ensure that we have credible capabilities, proven capabilities that form the basis of deterrence going forward into the future. You know, you can't deter somebody without a credible capability. Saying you can kick somebody's ass does not deter them. You know, you've got to at least demonstrate that you can kick somebody's ass. and preferably not, you know, the smallest kid in the schoolyard.
No, you got to fight. You got to fight the bully. I got asked recently when I was doing post-traumatic winning. You know, bullying's a big part of of some of the issues we have. You know, do you have what yes. do you say to people that ask you about bullying? I said you got to fight them, and they looked at me like what? I said you got to let that person fight the bully. And they said really? And I said look, bullies don't pick on people that fight them. They pick on the weak, and you've got to somehow help that person, you know, that's going through that to not be weak anymore. How do you do that? I said,
that's right.
And they looked at me like, who are you? What? I mean, because we used to be able to do that, and I don't know. I think that our current system of dealing with bullies, all it does is perpetuates the bullying. And I'm not a fan of it particularly. So anyway, interesting stuff. But Woody, you are spot on. But those are pretty broad, you know, mandates to deal with. Those are huge tectonic plates. And is the next war you're actually going to fight going to be someplace else? And so you again, that's the art of this. So. And then I want to add, here's an email that is a question that we talked about before. Mac, ask Woody the question about what the Commandant said about downsizing. That pool of money is different from training and equipment money. Is Congress going to be brought along? Because if they don't agree to transfer those pots of money, then you've downsized. I imagine General Berger has discounted for that. Curious about Woody's thoughts.
No, that's exactly correct. You know, money coming from Congress is appropriated for specific purposes. And you're right. The military personnel money is for paying the salary and benefits of military personnel. If you downsize your end strength, sure, there's a savings, if you will, or cost avoidance there in that military personnel money, but it's not necessarily transferable unless Congress approves that.
Right.
And unless that, frankly, that multi-layer deal is cut and very, very clear and solid on the front end. The risk is, frankly, you downsize the Marine Corps, you accrue a certain amount of savings in your military personnel appropriations, that slice of the budget, and then that gets vacuumed up by someone else, the Department of the Navy, DOD, or Congress just cuts your top line. And you really didn't create any resources that way. You may have solved somebody else's problem, but it's not like you've created a pool of resources that the Marine Corps is authorized to move around and to, for example, buy additional equipment or invest in additional training programs, what have you. So it's a very detailed and very careful fight that the Commandant and General Jansen at Programs and Resources, the Assistant Commandant, General Thomas, have to fight to ensure that if we were to, and I'm not saying this is going to happen, but if we were to reduce the end strength in the Marine Corps and save money in military personnel appropriations, that we could somehow use that money. There's no guarantee in that. So that's I think what you're the questioner is asking about. And yes, it's risky, and it requires some really careful and detailed work, and some very careful deal making to ensure that that happens.
Hey, we're no stranger to a deal on Capitol Hill. I mean, come on, do we need to reconstitute? Do I need to remind anybody do we need to reconstitute the Charter Society? I mean, what the hell?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. We've got it in our DNA in the Marine Corps to do those sorts of deals and to look at how we come up with a strategy for making deals and how we influence that. And, the Charter Society is one aspect of that. I would tell you that was the original purpose behind, the association, the Marine Corps Association and the Gazette, was back in 1913 and prior, was putting together an organization of primarily at the time Marine officers to come up with our means, our method, our strategy for defending ourselves from the Navy and the Army, for defending ourselves in Congress, and for essentially bettering the service, but also ensuring our existence. You talked about the Gazette archives. I came across an article recently by Colonel Robert Heinel, R.D. Heinel,
right,
from the 50th, it was 1963, the 50th anniversary of the founding of the association. And he had done some research into, folks' original letters and journals. And it's really there in black and white. So much of that creation of a professional association was dedicated to defending ourselves and defending the existence of the Marine Corps.
You know what? I mean, when you go through Marine Corps history, first of all, that name, Heinel, I mean, when you looked Marine Corps, right, that name was, I mean, all over the Gazette, man. That name was, right? That name was everywhere. I mean, it's just as just a prolific writer.
And published author, Soldiers of the Sea.
Oh my God!
Brass. I mean, he is very, very much one of certainly one of the biggest names of Marine Corps historians. And his contribution to our legacy is just enormous.
Hey, Woody, give us a foot. Who was that guy? I mean, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I mean, I've seen his books everywhere. Who was he? Was he a Marine officer? Was he?
Yep, he was ultimately retired as a colonel, a bird colonel, Robert Debs Heinel, H-E-I-N-L, and he had studied history in his early life, and also had established something of a reputation as a writer and journalist. And, again, used those talents primarily for, writing history, but obviously also a prolific contributor to the Gazette as the professional journal of the Corps. Some of those books that we mentioned are, while they're still on the Commandant's reading list and are very much the canon, if you will, the required reading of Marine Corps history. Our origins, Soldiers of the Sea, to the early history of the Marine Corps, Coral and Brass, the legacy of the Marine Corps established in World War II. These were his life work projects.
I'm embarrassed to say that that I didn't know that, but it is the truth. But his name was on everything. I mean, it reminds me of, whenever I think history, sometimes it's, Churchill saying, "I know history will be kind to me because I will write it." Heinel essentially writes, I mean, everything that I, not everything, but a lot. You couldn't read anything about the Marine Corps relative to World War II, middle century, 20th century, without his name being somewhere prominently among the titles of it.
Well, and I want to correct myself as well. Coral and Brass actually was authored by Holland M. Smith.
Right.
Heinel was his editor and contributor, if you will, sort of behind the scenes.
Right.
But his, I mean, he wrote on almost every major battle in the Pacific Theater as Marine Corps semi-official histories, Midway, Wake, you know, certainly all the early battles. And then, you know, later on, he combined a lot of these things together into books, history books. And he actually retired as a lieutenant colonel, not a bird colonel.
Oh, way to go. Way to promote him.
Well, you know, certainly by reputation and by the product, by the output.
He certainly should have been among you senators of the Marine Corps. I would say that. All right, let's talk about the. I appreciate you talking current events with me, but again, you can't talk too much about the Marine Corps without that subject coming up and the amount of interest by a lot of people. How is this going to happen? What's the scope? How does it make sense? Will history, you know, define it as a good move or a bad move and all the rest of that stuff? So very interesting. And you know, it's going to be great for the Gazette. I mean, it will be the place where this issue is discussed as well as on All Marine Radio. And again, it's a place where you find historical context for it because the Marine Corps is not a stranger to innovation throughout the history. You talk about guys like Ellis. You talk about guys like Krulak. I mean, they set the Marine Corps on a course that's always been innovative in an effort to, first of all, ensure its survivability. And so it's always been a part of our DNA. So we'll see if this is just another chapter in all of that, yes?
Exactly.
All right. Exactly. Let's talk about the Gazette this month. What's going on?
So your December edition, you know, there's articles, there's content in there that touches on all these areas that we just discussed and others. Of note in December, you've got we published the winning essays, the winning entries in two of our annual writing contests. The Major General Chase essays, you know, number one essay there is by a captain, Captain Eli Morales. Title of the essay is Deepening Interoperability, and it's about combined fleet operations. So in other words, Marines on U.S. Navy ships, on Allied naval ships, operating in the, you know, the Indo-PACOM area of responsibility. And so, you know, here's a young captain writing on an aspect of future fleet operations. And looking at a, you know, kind of a novel solution to the shortage or the unavailability of amphibious ships. And that is using, leveraging allies and partner nation naval ships. And so building alliances in the with our existing treaty partners in the Pacific area. Very interesting article. I'll point out also that some of these articles from December have already gotten attention from the relevant general officers. So in other words, senior Marine Corps leaders who are you know, that's their swim lane have already written letters into letters to the editor about these articles. So as an example, that one. Captain Morales' article, Major General Skolenka, Steve Skolenka, who is currently the J-5, the strategy officer for U.S. Indo-PACOM out in Hawaii, wrote a letter to the editor thanking Captain Morales for his article and not really criticizing it, but sort of giving him the rest of the story. And so between the article and that senior leader's response to that article, your readers get a much more complete picture and more complete knowledge on that issue. His letter is available online right now in the Gazette forum. Several other senior leaders have commented on articles in December as well. You've also got the three winners of this is the second annual Lieutenant General Mick Traynor Writing Award. And, not surprisingly, the winning essay is entitled Small Boats. And Captain Walker Mills wrote that. And I would point out Walker is another prolific author for the Gazette. He's been writing for us really since he was a lieutenant. And the small boats in question are not the Zodiacs of our vintage. We're talking about Marines potentially crewing or assisting sailors in crewing small patrol craft. So smaller signature, potentially highly lethal small boats operating in congested sea space. So another operational model of how the Marine Corps can contribute to a naval campaign to contest access and sea control. And there's second places and runners up in both of those essay contests published in this in December's magazine. A variety of other subjects, command and control, amphib operations, and then a good chunk on leadership as well. I'd like to highlight one under the leadership subject area. This is an article by Captain Jake Johnson, who wrote it while he was a student at Expeditionary Warfare School. And the title is Toward a Better Slogan, essentially calling out Protect What You've Earned as not the best slogan for leadership purposes in the Marine Corps, and really starting a discussion about what would a better slogan be, again focusing on what you and I have talked about, Mac, those fundamental individual and small unit discipline subjects. What sort of a campaign, what sort of a slogan would be better used to us in terms of letters back, Brigadier General Sean Saline, who is the Director of Marine Corps Communications, wrote a letter back on that article that you can find online as well, and that'll appear in print in January. So pretty wide range here. You mentioned earlier about artillery going away. We have an article this month by Captain Sean Carrion on reorganization of artillery. So, does tube artillery go away, or is it reduced? And if so, what takes its place? Do we double down on HIMARS? Do we double down on some other form of rocket artillery? What exactly does that look like, and what's the best solution for the future?
Wow. Must be pretty exciting for you. I mean, you and I have talked about let me ask you, are you receiving more things from people relative to writing? Because you and I both come from being captains in a day and age when maneuver warfare was just being introduced to the Marine Corps as a concept, and the debates that went on about that. Are you receiving more entries relative to writing? Because it's not a small part, this intellectual endeavor that we all participate in.
No, you're absolutely right, and the good news is very very healthy volume of submissions of essays that goes for our writing contests, but also for what I call just general submissions to the magazine. There's really no, it's really pretty humbling. I mean, there's no shortage of Marines out there who choose to dedicate some time and effort to writing for their, their professional journal, who want to participate in that dialogue, debate, that intellectual life of the Marine Corps. And it's one of the reasons why I'm very encouraged that senior officers are, maybe they're not writing, complete articles to support or rebut an argument that they've that they've read in the magazine, but they're writing letters to the editor talking to that author and thanking them for, you know, being a part of the discussion. And also in some cases, you know, telling the rest of the story or expanding on the, on the content, from their perspective, which is, you know, often, a little more informed or a little closer to, you know, to the headquarters flagpole. So, very valuable. And I think it's very valuable to the authors as well. There's certainly, more interest, more content coming in now in the naval integration, modernization, force design, innovation subject areas. But, you know, you mentioned maneuver warfare, and second place winner in this year's Chase essay contest was Captain Jason Mahuna, writing an essay entitled 30-Second Decision Makers, and he's writing specifically about the Boyd cycle, about the OODA loop,
right,
and the need to focus on the orient, okay, so the second O in the OODA loop, and training methods and the needs to teach and educate decision makers in how to analyze and synthesize the information they're bringing in, again, as part of that second step in the OODA loop in order to make better decisions and drive a faster cycle than your opponent. So yeah, it's alive and well, and I'm very encouraged by it.
You know, to your first point, like, it's called leadership by example, right? I mean, and that's been you know, one of the hallmarks of leadership in the Marine Corps, is if you want a certain type of behavior, you know, subordinates will tend to model it, and so, but you've got to do it, and so
that's exactly right.
We can, and I'll tell you where I see it, Woody. I go around when I speak, and in fact, when I was just at the Cornerstone event in late October in Quantico, I came by to see you, but I didn't have very much time, and you were tied up. So anyway, I was hoping to get free lunch out of you. General Mullen introduces it, and now I've done this for probably close to 40,000 people in the last year, and the power, and it started with General Furness doing this, but the power when somebody like General Mullen will introduce it, and he looks at all the people that are going to be regimental, group, squadron, battalion commanders, sir sergeant majors, and their spouses, and say, let me tell you why I'm here. I believe this is important. And then he tells a story about he was a first lieutenant, I believe, and he was on UDP to Okinawa, and his 11-year-old brother, the one that came late, right, 10 years after everybody else, his little guy that he helped raise and who went everywhere with him, who was so proud of him as a Marine officer, drowned after heavy rain in Philadelphia, slipped and fell into a creek and then was sucked into a culvert. And he talks about how crushing it is. And he said that, look, every one of us sitting in here has these things in our lives. And I want you to know why this is so important. And the difference in just the whole approach that everybody has, when somebody will stand up of that caliber to be brutally honest with them and tell them, you know, something true, to me, if you want that behavior, the general officers of the Marine Corps gotta, you know, you can't tell everybody else to write. And just like when somebody stands up and says, if you can imagine the Mullen example, and then somebody else stands up and says, hey, this is really important, and I want everybody to pay attention to it. Totally empty, you know, and I'm not going to call anybody out for it, but totally empty. They've heard it a million times. You know, what makes this any different? So, what you're saying, I think, is absolutely important. It's, in my opinion, really important that active general officers and sergeant majors write about these things and model that behavior. The other thing I will tell you this, and this comes from my experience teaching decision making, the second O is the head in the game piece of all of this.
Exactly.
If you didn't learn to keep your head in the game when you played Little League, if you don't know that the situation changes between one out and two outs, right, with runners at first and second, and the play you're going to make, if you don't see that it changes when the ball's hitting a gap as opposed to hit at somebody, then you need to really go to school. And that, to me, is the key part of it. It is your head in the game. It is. There is no good or bad technique. The only thing that screws a technique up is the misapplication into the wrong situation, and that's normally done because the second O is screwed up.
Exactly.
And so exactly. Anyway. So I love this stuff. I think it's awesome. And I should probably read that article and write something because you're looking at people that are physically fit, really smart. What's the difference between a good decision maker and a bad decision maker? And it is that head in the game aspect. It's your devotion to your craft. And I remember General Caulfield. Do you remember General Caulfield? I think it was Matthew Caulfield. I heard him speak at a PME once, and he said, I went to Quezon as an operations officer. They were already there. And I believe he said, when I got off the helicopter, I was not confused or overwhelmed because of the reading I had done.
Right.
And he was an incredible reader, right? He said, the things I saw all made sense to me in the context of all the different things I'd experienced through books. And now there's a plethora of ways you can experience things. But I think that part of that's that second O, that you can prepare yourself constantly. And I tell a story about techniques and about being smart when I would do my decision-making class. And I put up essentially, I got it from AWS at the time, but it was the staff planning process during World War II. Now, I don't know if you remember this, Woody, but it was a series of boxes that went from the upper left-hand corner, and it built like underneath each other until it got to the edge of the right of the piece of paper, and then it went vertically down, and then it went back across, right?
Yeah.
Right? You remember that? And you would put that up, and everybody would groan.
Eyes would glaze over.
right. And I said, wait a minute, right? Nobody wants to do that, right? That's what won World War II. That process right there. Everything that you see on everything you see on the History Channel and all those movies and videotapes, that did that. That's a pretty good tool right there, as much as everybody's groaning about it, right? And then, but everybody loves recognition prime decision making, right? Oh, blah, blah, blah. Yay, you put up the tic-tac-toe example. It's like, where does X go next? And everybody goes, there, upper left-hand corner. Right, okay. Techniques are neither good or bad. It's the misapplication, and it's the O that defines your ability to do that. And I've never forgot that, what General Caulfield told me.
No, you're right on. And the interesting thing is there's technological enhancements that can assist you with observation. There are communication technology and information technology tools that can help you push a decision out rapidly. But nothing helps you with orientation but you. It's all software, all right? It's all inside your skull. And, what you do to prepare yourself, reading, the study of not just reading military history, but studying military history is part of what you do. That builds that experience that you need in order to do good decision making, whether it's recognition primed or recognitional or intuitive decision making or deliberate decision.
Or God forbid, analytical and win World War II.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Let's pull all those logistics, all those ship movements, all those troop movements, the training of everybody. Let's swag that one, right?
Yeah, let's do that intuitively.
Yeah. No, let's not and say we did. And yeah. So, no, I find that stuff fascinating. And again, Jeff Kinney, another thing, he goes, you want a new idea? Read an old book. I'm like, all right, Father Time. But you know what? He's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. So leadership by example and keeping your head in the game, things that we were taught as kids. Give me something else that might not be in the print edition, but on the in the digital edition that we should check out.
Online there's a number of articles out there that generate their own threads of discussion. There's one in particular point out that actually will be appearing in print a little later on. But it's actually part of a group of articles that are dealing with education for sea power. So how we specifically educate leaders to look at the strategy behind naval campaigns. So yes, there's integration, there's training and education for naval integration at the tactical level. But how do we develop leaders, recognizing that this is a years, decades long process to develop strategic thinkers for sea power? What do we do in our PME institutions now to support that? These articles are actually coming out of faculty and students at Naval Post Grad School sort of your way, Northern California, the Monterey. I'd encourage folks to start reading those online because the Navy, the Department of the Navy, is taking a very new and deliberate approach to education. And one aspect of that is education for sea power at the strategic level. So how we develop strategic leaders as the nation's fleet in the future.
You know, one of the things Jerome Berger's talked about is how the archaic way that we deliver education relative to the way universities deliver education. I know I did my show, you know, at the, you know, from 2000 to 2010 when I wasn't deployed at the city that was the home of the University of North Dakota. And one of the great things that they did relative to the business of the university was distance learning. And then all the different ways that you can experience a lecture now, that you can, you know, the biggest limiting factor was not being able to control lab-type experiments over the Internet. And they were trying to do pioneering research so that you could, you know, do virtual experiments online. And what that and the bottom line was what that would do for the bottom line. And it would do two things. One, it helps people that desperately are looking for quality higher education degrees. And two, obviously, the revenue that would be associated with it. General Berger's made comments about that. Have I not seen anything that's written in the course of how the Marine Corps is going to deliver professional military education so that we can expand the number of captains that get through EWS? I know there's the satellite programs now, and
right.
I think those are
seminars. Yep.
Yeah,
and
I think those are phenomenal.
The old traditional non-resident,
right.
AKA box of books, seminar PME. What I will tell you, Mac, is if you recall, there's a broad number of planning teams that are meeting now, really sort of right on the tail end of the force design planning effort. One of those is the training and education integrated process team, fancy name for a planning team, who's actually started meeting this week. And one of the things they're looking at is, all right, the force design planning effort tells us what this future force needs to look like and what capabilities Marines and different MOSs, different skill sets at different echelons of unit need to have. So the T&E planning effort is, okay, what do we need to do in the way we train and educate Marines to produce that kind of force? They're doing that work now. And what you described, essentially modernizing the delivery of training and education, beyond just doing, non-resident or distance programs, but taking, and I'll steal General Mullen's phrase here, taking learning out of the industrial age and into the information age and defining what that really means. So it's not just distributed or online, but it's more participatory. It's more learning by doing, vice learning through listening or reading, and then how the Corps, frankly, invests resources in order to deliver training and education that way is one of the things that they're looking at. It's more than how many how many course hours are given to a given subject. It's, you know, imagine, and this is, I actually had another author writing about this, but imagine if all your distance learning was conducted inside the context of a war game, so that, you know, if you're training or educating people to make tactical decisions, you don't just read about it or write a paper or take a multiple choice test, but every class is in fact a discrete fight, a discrete war game where you're getting multiple reps and sets actually making the decision that we're concerned about you being able to make in combat. I think it kind of wraps together several subjects that we were talking about earlier, but it is certainly a different and a new approach to education. I also know that the Navy's effort under a new chief learning officer, so a new position in the hierarchy of the Navy, and he happens to be a former Marine, Mr. Kroger. They are looking at, among other things, how this delivery of training is modernized to produce the sorts of leaders that we need at all levels. And then also they're also looking at what Marines and sailors do after leaving the service. And so they've developed this thing called the Navy Community College concept. So not just for your PME, but for everything that you do, from your MOS training to OJT, to your PME courses, leader development courses, having all of that accredited so our Marines and sailors are leaving their, you know, their period of active duty with a bundle of recognized credit hours that contribute towards an associate's or a bachelor's or a master's degree when they leave the service. We've tried things like that in the past, but they've really taken that on board in the last few months.
All right, Woody, what have I not been smart enough to ask you over the course of the last hour about this issue of the Gazette that you need to get out there?
We pretty much covered the waterfront. I think we're good. I would point out the one thing that you'll see in November Gazette, December Gazette, there'll be some more, or there are some more online, is sort of all Mattis all the time. Lots of folks writing book reviews of Call Sign Chaos. To include myself. So you'll find some of those out there along with other reviewers. And the neat part about it is the book is good enough that really every one of these reviewers is sort of finding something different and of value in it as they write their reviews. So that's you do need to read the book, but if you're pressed for time, you could probably read several of these reviews and certainly get the basic gist.
And fake like you read it and then impress all your friends.
Yeah, they're those people are out.
The
Reader's Digest crib notes or cliff notes, folks.
Give me your the essence of your critique of or your a review of his book. Give me the essence of what you said.
I would tell you that it's the book is I think very valuable for anyone, any of the joint services in a leadership position at multiple levels, because what it really is it's a collection of very well curated vignettes, each of which illustrates some very key points about the application of Marine Corps leadership at different levels, from direct leadership, small unit tactical level, all the way up through the theater level of a geographic combatant commander. And so very, very valuable, regardless of, you know, whether you're actually the leader at that level or you aspire to be, or you're in one of the jobs that has to support a leader at that level. So you know, very, very interesting, very valuable there. It's very authentic and genuine, and entertaining, because it is all first person. But I would also say that it's, you know, there are only about 14 people who have ever been the commander of U.S. Central Command. Okay, so that's a very small population. It's kind of hard for a general audience to relate to what it's like to be a leader at that level. The book does a great job of making that accessible and human, and sort of it does it, but it just describes sort of the daily battle rhythm for a commander at that level, four-star geographic combatant command level, particularly in CENTCOM, which is a somewhat active theater. It humanizes it and makes it something that I think anybody can relate to. So, you know, summing it up, definitely worth a Marine's time to read, and probably worth a lot of other leaders' time to read as well.
Well, you know, one of the things, and I'd just be curious about this, and then I'll let you go, is, and it might have been you that told me this, so you can don't be afraid to embrace yourself if this was you, but the way that the lens of the book adjusts as he goes through his career, from, you know, first it's all first person stuff, and then later on it's, you know, leading leaders of leaders, and how his style, you know, has to change and adjust throughout. Your comment or thoughts on that? Did I get that from you?
Maybe not in those words, but pretty similar. And I think, it's really very evident, you know, in these different, the three main sections, if you will, or in the organization of the book, take it from the, the direct leadership level, which is where you're, you know, there's shared hardship, there's shared danger. You're looking the people that you lead in the eye every day, up through the strategic level of leadership, which is very, very different. As you say, it's leading leaders, but it's influencing environments at that level. The general describes it in the book as the trigonometry level of war. I would say it's probably closer to the differential calculus level of war when you come right down to it.
That's pretty intimidating, I'm not going to lie to you. I did not hang out in that class.
I'm not going to comment. I might have started it, but I...
I did not.
I might have needed to drop that one.
Well, you know what? I will say this,
never
though.
Never been good at math, Mac. Never been good at math.
I was stupid enough to declare I love history, right? So I go to Junior College of California, and the best class I took at Consumnes River College was an economics history class. And the guy who taught it is a guy named Bing Howell. His father was the ambassador to Great Britain from Trinidad. And so he grew up in London. And fascinating guy. But he made the class so interesting that I thought, what do you mean we were not in Latin America to spread peace and democracy? Like, who is the Continental Can Company and the United Fruit Corporation? Like, what is that? And so it was like...
Talk to Smedley Butler about that.
Oh, my God, I know, right? So it's like pulling democracy's pants down. And so I thought, well, in order for me to understand history, that I should understand economics that I don't rightly understand. And so I when I went to the University of San Diego, I declared economics as my major.
Don't.
Oh, exactly. Right? So it's like applied mathematics for like 3 years. And I didn't know that shit. And then I got so far into it by the time I realized it that I couldn't get out of it without extending my time in college. And I wasn't going to do that. So I had to gut it out. But I will say this. The way I solve problems, I think I was greatly benefited by that constant drill of, okay, we're going to take this model and we're going to move it in time through four different variables, and we're going to talk about
right.
that. Right. Now, I had to, because I could not get out of that major right? I had to put my earplugs in to keep my brain from falling out of my head, and I had to learn that shit. But I will tell you that it affected the way I approach problem solving in terms of what is assumed here, and let's talk about if we don't assume that, then what happens to the problem? And all of a sudden the sides blow out of the solution, and then you're much freer to do certain things. And so, yeah, interesting.
Well, it's proof of the...
I used to warn guys like you, Woody. You'd walk in like, hey, money and banking. And there was like 8 economics major at the university. And we were all together like for 3 classes during the week. And guys like you would walk in like, hey, what's going on? I'm like, and I'd look up and I'm like, and I was a normal guy. I wasn't a dork. I was like, hey, man, what's going on? Hey, I'm Chris Woodbridge. Hey, Mac, what's going on? Are you a new major to economics? Oh, no. I'm a business grad. I'm a business guy. I just thought this would be interesting. Okay, look, sit through the class and then drop it today. And you look at me like, what? Like, look, this is applied math and you don't want to be in here. Okay, it's upper division class. You can take money and banking as a lower division economic class and that's all right. But yeah, you don't want to be in here. And then at the end of the class, you'd look at me and you're like, hey man, thanks a lot. So I was that guy, man.
So you don't have that moment with the professor, you put your hand up, sir, I was told there'd be no math in this course.
It's all that
long answer.
Yeah, it's all it is. We trick everybody like that shit.
Proof of the old saying, a little bit of knowledge is dangerous and a lot is painful.
That's, you know what? That's the truth. That is the truth. No, but if for those of us that have followed, you know, General Mattis, his discussions about his books, I mean, to me, he's just really, and all these guys are. I mean, that's why I say my job is just so interesting in terms of being able to talk to generals like Zinni, like Van Riper, about leadership and about discipline and about all the things that we talk about. And General Mattis is, you know, second to none in terms of intellect. And also, if you want to see a rock star around the world relative to national security issues, watch what happens when he goes to something like the Shangri-La Dialogues or the Aspen Security Conference or something like that. Professional people get a Twitter, and I don't mean the application. They get, I mean, off the hook excited because he is astute, he's bright, he's, you know, experienced, and always insightful. So I don't think you can go wrong being in the discussion with call sign chaos and reading what other people think. And I would start with Woody's because Woody's paid attention to him for years, served underneath him, and a good student. So anyway, Woody, I've kept you too long. Thank you very much for hanging out with me.
No worries, Mac. Glad to do it. And take care. We'll probably see you in the near future out in California.
You bet. All right. Thanks, Woody.
All right.
Chris Woodbridge here on a... Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on your home for it, the one and only Mother Lovin', right? All Warrior Radio Network. That'll do it for today. We're going to talk leadership tomorrow and business. Yeah, Mike Ettore, otherwise known as Mike Ettore. He'll show up tomorrow and we'll talk leadership. Call sign chaos. Interesting read. Interesting read. So, on a Tuesday, have a great day. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life. Okay? Do not be afraid to change somebody's life. Trust me. Trust me on this one. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life. Nothing but good happens because of it. Nothing but good. And again, I, on the way out the door, I'll share this text message one more time because it's so cool. So I'm bombing around minding my own business, right? And this popped into my phone yesterday. And again, I say this hopefully to inspire you because... as everybody knows, there's nothing you can do about the trauma that's already in your life. The only thing you can do is create joyful event after joyful event after joyful event after joyful event. Okay? And by doing that, what you'll do is you will overwhelm those traumatic experiences with joyful experiences. You'll also give meaning to your suffering, which is important. Everybody got it? All right. And so when you do that, things like this happen to you. Hey, Mac, my name is XYZ, right? I've been listening to Allmarine Radio off and on for over a year now. And I left the part out where he says his family turned him on to it. I just wanted to tell you how happy you've made my family. You brought my brother out of a dark spot that I never thought he would exit. Semper Fi, sir, and keep changing lives. So imagine just cruising through your afternoon and that falls into your lap. Like, what do you do? How happy are you? Exactly. You're that happy. You know where Snoopy's got his nose up in the air and it's a still picture and he's got his feet vibrating and his tail wagging? That picture? That's what that's like. The Snoopy. The happy Snoopy. Yeah, for the rest of the day. And the day after. So, anyway. Go change somebody's life. On a Tuesday, the 10th day of December. Have a great afternoon. Allmarine Radio over and... You hear Joe there? Joe knows the program's ending. He hears this music. And he knows he's going to get petted as soon as I get off the air. Yeah, Joe's a smart dog. Anyway, have a great afternoon. Allmarine Radio over and... Out.